From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Native Californian Julia Harris holds an MFA in creative writing from the University of Notre Dame, but she now works at The Ohio State University as a staff writer for On Campus, the OSU staff and faculty newspaper. She's also a regular blogger and social media fan, so we'll talk to her about the move from print to online writing. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Julia Harris.
Thank you, Doug Dangler.
Well, thank you. How did you go from a creative writing background, the big question, to the more journalistic style of writing, such as On Campus, which you've brought here?
Yes, I was told to bring visual aids.
Yes, all of the things that you have written on cover stories for this newspaper. So tell me how that worked. You were at getting an MFA and decided, I'm going to write for newspapers.
No. I just needed a job, really, is how it worked out. An MFA is not the most practical of degrees. I mean, I hate to burst anybody's bubble, but really, it's for people who want to write the great American novel, or at least the so-so American novel that's eventually going to get published. So I didn't end up going that route. Actually, I got somewhat disillusioned in graduate school.
It's hard to tell.
That I'm disillusioned?
Yeah, from what you just said, that you might be disillusioned.
I was trying to cover it up.
Okay, go on.
Thank you for blowing my cover.
That's fine.
So at Notre Dame, I graduated, got married, and then my husband came to Ohio State for his graduate degree. Mm-hmm. And
not an MFA, apparently.
Not an MFA. No, he got a real degree in, did I just say that?
Ooh.
Ancient history, actually. Yeah, in the history of the church, actually.
Okay.
He's now a pastor, so he's actually doing something with his degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a job at Ohio State, working first for an educational publishing group through the College of Education. And then the funding for that ran out, and I applied for this position, and it's been the best thing that's ever happened to me, really. And I don't mean that to sound disillusioned.
Okay.
I'm trying to be sincere, because it's true.
Well, tell me about writing for On Campus, or for writing, doing newspaper writing. This is a different kind of newspaper. It's not the same as working at the Dispatch.
No.
So it's a different genre, but it's a common genre that you would see at large universities or at large companies, where they would want to publicize sort of their internal goings on. So tell me about that.
We like to think of On Campus as a way to create community across Ohio State for the vast amount of staff and faculty. I believe the number I've heard is 27,000 at all the various outposts, the regional campuses, the university's medical center. And so pretty much everybody's supposed to get one of these in their mailboxes. Every other week we have is it bi-weekly or bi-monthly if it's every other week?
Yeah, I think it's bi-weekly,
okay.
Every 2 weeks.
But. So this comes out every other week, and we tell stories that have to do with things that are hopefully of interest to staff and faculty, things that they're doing in their labs, things they're doing as outreach and engagement with the community or the state or even the nation and the world. And, with President Gee's emphasis now on the one university and building collaboration, that's a huge focus for our stories, too.
Okay. So how do you identify a story? Here's the background of that. I like to imagine that the editor of this, who I don't know, that all newspaper editors are like J. Jonah Jameson, out of Spider-Man, smoking a cigar and screaming, bring me his head. But
that's really not what my editor is like.
Okay.
No, but thanks for the picture.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I don't even think he smokes. We have meetings where we talk about sort of what's going on, and we all have beats, actually. It's sort of, I don't know that we actually use that word anymore, but we have areas that we focus on. And I am the sort of the cultural, I guess, arts and performance and things like that on campus. Plus, I cover a lot of the outreach and engagement type stories. So we have our little contacts. I believe we did a story on you, actually.
Well, it was on Writer's Talk.
And another story on you.
Yeah, well, it was Writer's Talk, but that's not why she's here. But what I'd like to know about is, so you get these assignments and you think, here's where we go, and how do you decide what's worth pursuing, what's not worth pursuing? There's so many things going on at Ohio State. What makes something newsworthy?
Well, I guess that's it's pretty subjective. I mean, something that I think would be interesting maybe other people wouldn't. I mean, like art exhibits, for instance. I did a story on the bird polar 50th anniversary art exhibit that's at the library. Now, it's a university-wide thing. Bird polar is a huge center that we have, and polar research, and you know, Lonnie Thompson and Ellen Mosley Thompson are two of our big celebrities in terms of climate change and that kind of climatology research, things like that. So that story hit on a lot of different fronts. You know, it had the research angle, it had some history, it had arts, which is, you know, sort of my angle, and it had, it's at the library, so it's a university community sort of a story. So to me, that covered a lot of ground. So whether anybody's actually read it or not remains to be.
I read it.
Oh, did you? And yeah. You thought it was fabulous, right?
I thought it was fabulous, yes. Okay. So you go, you talk to Lonnie Thompson and Ellen Mosley Thompson.
I didn't actually speak with them, but they are referenced in this piece because they are affiliated with the Bird Polar Research Center.
Because my curiosity is, you've got all these different places that you can go for information at OSU. One of them is a primary source. Mm-hmm. So you have a ton of primary sources to go to, but then what? Where's your next avenue? What does a journalist then do? Or where do you go from there?
Where do I go from there? Well, we always like to have two sources at the very least. Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, I don't do the hard-hitting research stories. So let's say, like, for instance, this Defenders of the Brand story that I wrote, which was about trademark and licensing. They are the ones who decide what tchotchkes can be sold with Ohio State labels on them and things like that. So I had a contact in the office who's, like, I guess the vice president. And I went and talked to him, and then we had the actual director of the office come and talk. So it kind of organically leads itself to who you're supposed to talk to after you've made that first contact. And so this one was one of my favorite stories, actually.
Why was
it a favorite? Because I got some free T-shirts out of it.
Oh, okay. So graft and corruption.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. tell me about the process, though, on this, because I would think that you go in, you would talk to them, and the first question that comes to my mind is, okay, I've seen a lot of the stuff that's been approved. What doesn't get approved? You know, what isn't approved? And how far do you get to go in following your own personal interest to find out what's going to make it in, what's not going to make it in?
Well, I did actually ask them what doesn't get approved and how do they decide. They sort of have a fairly subjective scale. They admitted that if they think it's in bad taste, and so they are the arbiters of good taste, I suppose. And they've approved things like a coffin, scarlet and gray coffin, toilet seats with the scarlet and gray.
Are they in the OSU block O shape? Or
I assume that the block O would be the, I don't know, I've never actually seen one.
Okay.
But I know that they have approved it. On the cover there are things like, one of the things that did not get approved was this bowling pin thing.
But yet it's there.
Because, well, it was in the closet of contraband that I got to go into and sort of look around and say, aha. So apparently this label wasn't, didn't match up right or something like that. So it got sent back and they said, you know, if you can resubmit this with the labels lined up, perhaps we will approve this.
Okay.
So, but one thing they didn't approve is prophylactic.
Oh, I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see that. What are your lead times with something like this? Because you're not only working with the print edition, you're working with the online version.
Yeah.
And has the emergence of the online version of the paper changed your deadlines at all? Do you have to have it in earlier? Does it not matter to them? They go to the printer and then they send it off at the same time to the people who are going to do the web versions.
I am the people who do the web version.
Really?
So yeah. So that hasn't actually changed. It comes out on a Thursday of the production week, of the publication week. So Wednesday, the day before it hits the stand, is when I put it online.
Okay.
So, although it has sort of changed, we're really trying to figure out how to bridge the gap between the print and the online. Because print, you can sort of get away with being longer, you know, although it would seem like it would make sense that with online you could just scroll, but people don't want to scroll. So if it's too long to read, they're not going to read it. And so as I've been putting stories up, we'll often have those sidebars, and my tendency is just keep tacking them on at the end of the actual online story. And my editor, the one who doesn't smoke and ask for people's heads, is the one that comes in and says, let's make this a separate story, a separate post. So he kind of breaks those things out. And
how does that affect you as a writer? I mean, you're revamping the story for online, which is the story that we've heard for a long time, that as journalism is changing, and this is serious business. I mean, there are newspapers all over the place going out of business. Mm-hmm. These kind of papers are not in danger, I would assume, of going out of business, but they're impacted by all that.
Sure. We're very fortunate, and we recognize that we have kind of a niche market. And so the print isn't going to go away. And our advertising base, which is where I think a lot of the other more traditional newspapers are struggling, our advertising base isn't going away. They love On Campus. They continue to come back to us. They say that we are a valuable means for them to get their message out. So, you know, and we've got a lot of support from the university, so we don't feel like we're in danger of going under. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty good. I wanted to show you this one story that I did, my one of my recent ones, called The Firebuck. The Firebuck stops here. This was one of the stories that we did with an eye at the beginning for online. So I wrote this story knowing that it was going to go online with a movie that I shot. Mm-hmm. And that's something else that we're trying to explore, is to do multimedia. And that's something, obviously, that you can't do with this static paper. And so I went to, the story is, this guy bought a fire truck online and is going to trick it out to be an Ohio State fire truck.
You don't get tricked out fire truck in the same sentence a lot. But
you don't.
That's pimp this truck.
Fire truck, right. Exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, the clever little title, The Fire Buck Stops Here. Mm-hmm. I thought that was cute. Anyway, so this was for a feature that we do called Off Campus, which is the sort of the quirky, funny things that staff people do when they're not on the clock. So Travis Van Ness bought this truck, and he's getting it sort of refurbished and painted and all this kind of stuff. So I went to his the garage where he's getting this done, just about knocked out with the paint fumes that were in there, and I had my little camera, and he talked and walked around the truck, and then he blew the horn and just about exploded my head, and the camera fell, which makes for some nice footage.
I saw that footage, and I was concerned for your health and
you.
For the camera.
I appreciate that. The camera is okay. My ears are recovering, but that has had 2,000 hits online.
Okay.
By far the most popular thing we've ever done. So I'm not saying that because of my writing or whatever. It's just, it has that visual appeal. It has a good story. It has all the, you know, it's banging on all cylinders.
But how does that change you as a writer? Because instead of writing things down in the notebook, you're now looking at it very differently. You've got to look at it in a visual sense. You've got to think, what can I show? What kind of pictures? What kind of video is going to play? Whereas that, there was never a thought of it. I mean, there was maybe a picture, but it used in the old days, you probably would have taken a photographer all along.
Yeah.
But now it's all you. It's sort of Max Headroom. You remember Max Headroom?
I do.
Where, yeah, the guy, just one guy, camera, going around, shooting everything, being the editor, the producer, and then you just set that artifact on the desk. Mm-hmm. And does that change the relationship between the reporter and the editor? Because how is the editor going to say, you know, here's these seconds, 5 seconds I don't like in the video, take them out? Do you get things like that?
Well, Jake Hausch, who does a lot of the new media things that go up online, the videos and things like that, very fortunate to have him in my office area. And he and his students did sort of edit that, and they took some of the audio out and scrolled it over the top of the footage. So, but yeah, it does change how you approach a story. I mean, even if something has a purely aesthetic, you know, intellectually aesthetically pleasing story, you know, you can't, if it doesn't have good pictures, if it doesn't have a good multimedia component, then you're less likely to want to pursue it as aggressively as you might otherwise.
Okay.
So,
do you see that happening when you look at, say, local papers like the Dispatch?
I don't look at the Dispatch.
Okay. If you look at other papers, do you see that occurring? Do you make that same argument? Because I see videos on different websites for newspapers and think, okay, this is a really interesting moment because people are moving from purely word-driven, although there were always photographs, to something else. And I think that that changes the nature of being a writer.
It does, but you still have to be able to tell a good story. And if you can't put words together to tell a story, then your video footage isn't going to hold up. It's not going to have the scaffolding to hold it.
Did you have to come back later and do a voiceover for the video?
No, I did not. And we're sort of going with the gritty realism aspect of the footage.
Ohio State, gritty realism. Okay.
Well, you know, not the flip camera where there's the palsy of the shaking and it's all dirty and grainy, whatever. But I believe the feel of it was, yeah, let's have it be what it is. It's me with a camera trying to capture this guy's story. It's not this high gloss, super produced piece. So for that, it is what it is. And I think trying to pretend that it was something other than that would have been a travesty.
And that puts you very much in a different kind of journalism, as you said. And I know that we've discussed whether at other times whether you're a journalist or a writer, and you have very strong opinions on that. But in terms of this, you know, if a journalist, it's a very different thing, because now you're inserting yourself into the writing of it. And, you know, if you flinch at the end when somebody blows the horn, everybody sees that, you know. And so it humanizes the process,
right,
maybe.
Right.
Or makes it much clearer that this is something that's not as objective as maybe it was in the past.
Although I think objective journalism is pretty much on the decline. I mean, so much is with the social media and the way the blogs and everything, people are putting their opinion into everything because there's just, why else would you read something? You get a sense of the person who's writing it. And even in my writing for the paper, you know, I've never been the fly on the wall, totally objective, this is just the facts. You know, because you're telling a story, and all writing to me is personal, which means there's a person in it, you know. Yeah.
Well, let's turn to some of the personal writing that you've done, because you also blog.
Yeah.
And you make no secret of being a blogger, so we can bring up some of that. And I think you've got a reading that you'd like to do.
Yeah, I do.
For the blog. Why don't you set this up for me and tell me to tell for us.
Well, this post is called Walmart. It's How I Roll. And the context is I was working on getting a costume together for my 8-year-old son who had to do a book report presentation. And he had read Captain Underpants. I don't know if... Are you familiar with...
I am familiar with Captain Underpants.
Captain Underpants,
yes.
Is a large, mostly naked person in underwear with a red cape and stuff like that. So my son doesn't like reading much, but he had loved this book, and so I was really excited about it, and I was trying to go and get a costume for him.
So it's underpants and a cape.
Underpants and a cape.
He wants to be...
And I wanted to get, like, long underwear so that it would look like he was, like, the pale-colored underwear.
Okay.
So he could look naked without actually being naked.
Okay.
Right. Okay, and then it got into a sort of a philosophical rant about Walmart and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
All right. I have a love-hate thing with Walmart because it's cheap and convenient, but it inspires lust in me for things I don't need. And then there's the intellectual guilt I feel about shopping such an exploitative capitalist juggernaut that preys on small business and hunched-over people in Asia. That being said, I shop there all the time, and usually I'm not scarred by the experience. Tonight was an exception, and let's launch the fictionalized narrative now. Since I only have a few things in my arms, it seems like a no-brainer. Go to the 20 items or less checkout line. But of course, the man in front of me has 19.8 items, including 2 soggy rolls of ground turkey that leave foul streaks on the counter. I put the package of men's underwear, 7 for the price of 6, even though I only need 1. Why can't they sell underwear in single servings? In the smear of turkey juice, because the underwear is safely wrapped in plastic, and besides, we don't intend to eat it. And then I put the package of kids' long underwear, beige, skin color, right? I figure this way Max can look naked without actually being naked, and then he can sleep in it when the report is done. Then the 2 pairs of boys' sleep pants for Alex, because you can't buy something for one boy without bringing home something for the other boy, right? It's a law of nature. And then the bag of chocolate-covered donut gems. The checkout lady is about as high off the ground as my chin, and her eyes light up when she sees the boys' jammies. Cute, she announces. I'm small enough that I sometimes wear boys' clothing. Everything on her looks squeezed like an overfilled tube of toothpaste. The idea of her pawing through little boy sleepwear makes me oddly uncomfortable, but I try to be friendly. "There's some cute stuff back there," I say. When the total is rung up and waiting to be paid, I hand her a gift card that I know has at least $8 on it. She gestures for me to run it through the card reader on my side of the counter. So I swipe it. Nothing happens. She says, "Press debit." There's no debit anywhere on the screen. "How about buy?" I offer, since that appears to be the closest applicable option. She stares at me, and the woman in line behind me begins to shift her weight from foot to foot. I press buy. The screen changes and her cash register beeps. "Hit debit," she says. There is still no debit. There's a happy little scrolling line. "Swipe, shop, save." I read that out loud to her. Her forehead furrows. "Swipe your card again." I swipe. The lady behind me sighs. Before the checkout lady can encourage me to hit the non-existent debit button again, I read out what the screen says. "Buy, load, cancel." I look into her concerned blue eyes. "I want to buy, right?" "It says load? What does that mean?" She leans closer to her machine, squinting. "Try swiping it again." I swipe, the machine beeps, the lady behind me sighs. Fortunately, at that point, a managerial-type woman comes over with her intensely long, intensely fuchsia fingernails, grabs my card, taps it against some magic part of the cash register, and voila, $8.38 is miraculously applied to my purchase. The joy and relief in the people behind me in line is almost palpable. Equally palpable is the despair they feel when I take out my checkbook to pay the remaining $24. "I'm really sorry," I say to the long-suffering lady next to me. She smiles, almost friendly. "No problem." I wipe the check and hand it to the tiny checkout lady, who scowls at it before feeding it into her machine. No one seems terribly surprised when the machine beeps. She takes it, turns it, shoves it in a different way. We all hold our breath until the machine beeps again. I can feel waves of hatred sweeping up from the back of the line toward me. I know how they feel because I hate people who write checks for things too, but when you've got no credit card and no cash, you're kind of screwed. She repeats the yank and feed process with the check two more times before the long-nailed woman reappears, looking at me with polite rage. "Having some trouble tonight, aren't we?" she says. "I'm not having any trouble, really. It seems to be all their trouble, but I just smile in what I hope is a suitably docile manner. Yes, aren't we?" The nailed woman takes the check and slides it into the machine. She says, "May I see your photo ID?" I take out my wallet and flip it open to my license, holding it up. She leans, peers, and smiles and says, "Could you take it out and read the numbers to me, please?" I begin to feel very wronged, like somehow their incompetence is my fault. And all for $24 for Pete's darn sake. But I'm a good girl, a model tax-paying suburban citizen with Jesus in my heart and a Captain Underpants costume to throw together. So I read the numbers to her while the line of people behind me vibrates with growing mutiny. Her fuchsia nails tap the numbers into the machine. "Thank you," she says. I start putting my wallet away. "I'm so very sorry," I say to the lady behind me. Fuchsia nails says, "Can I have your telephone number?" "It's just too much. I feel my face get hot." "Well, for crap's sake, how about a blood stick while you're at it? Or maybe my firstborn son?" This gets a laugh from the woman behind me. "How about a DNA sample?" Tiny checkout lady says, "It's getting pretty bad, isn't it?" But Fuchsia cannot be budged, so I finally give her my phone number. She whisks my check through her complicated, invasive machinery, and I'm finally free to take my one stupid darn shopping bag to my car, where I rip open the incredibly expensive bag of donuts and start shoving them in my face.
Okay, that was very nice.
Thank you.
It certainly makes me wish to go shopping.
Doesn't it? And to Walmart, I would imagine. Yes.
Well, there goes them as a sponsor. Tell me about you're writing this stuff and you're the way that it interacts with on campus. And as a writer, you know, you get to express yourself very differently here. And that's where you get to go to do the rant. And you've got the flip side. It's the sugar side on one side, the wholesome wheat goodness on the other side. Do you ever have the moments where those crash when they push against each other?
Unfortunately, they crash a lot.
A lot, okay.
Yeah.
I always wondered what happened in the middle of the frosted mini wheat. But what's the best writing advice you've gotten? What do you really tell people if you want to be able to go out, you want to be able to write for money? Here's the best advice I've gotten.
Well, there's the stereotypical write what you know. There's also the advice I give to people who are majoring in English. I say, change your major to engineering, really. Yeah. Okay. I feel very, very fortunate to have a job writing. I really do. It's hard to get a job that you love, and writing is one of those jobs that if you really want to be an author, you have to work hard, you have to be disciplined, and you have to be really, really good and really, really lucky.
How long does it take you to write a typical story? How much time do you put into it?
Not enough, probably. No. I probably, let's see, there's the interview, then I have to transcribe, and then the writing. So probably altogether, I would say 5 to 8 hours on a piece.
How much of it do you transcribe? Just what catches your ears, or are you transcribing the whole thing?
My editor would like me to transcribe only what catches my ear.
Okay. But you go that extra mile.
I feel like I might miss something if, you know. So, yeah, I am gradually becoming less dependent on my tape recorder. But I don't want to miss something that might be important.
Okay. That makes you sort of a very visual learner as opposed to an auditory learner, because that's how you get it, is to see it in words. You think that's what's behind you being a writer.
I've never thought about that.
Well, it's a question. Last question. How has the writing of the blog changed you as a writer?
I've probably become much more observational. Is that a word? I see things differently. Like, how would this turn into a funny story? Or, you know, what from this could be interesting to others? Mm-hmm. So writing a blog, and I had originally foolishly committed to doing one blog entry a day.
Oh.
Yeah, foolishly.
Yeah,
and it has gone by the wayside. Mm. But that was making me much more, I had to pay attention to what was going on around me in a different way, I thought. So it also has just freed me to write what I want to write.
It's curious because it suggests a certain artificiality in writers' experiences, in that instead of be here now, be in the moment, you're being in the moment as looking toward the future for what you're going to do with it. And I've talked to that about other writers, and it's an occupational hazard, it seems, that's just what happens to you. I think Truman Capote had a lot of stuff to say on that same topic. Who do you want to imitate or emulate online? Who do you think really does blogging well? Or you're the only blog you read?
I'm the only blog I read, because writers, I think, are very narcissistic, is sort of how I think it goes. I don't know. I actually don't read a lot of blogs online. I have a couple of friends who are blogging, but they're not humor writers. They're blogging their life experiences. One of them has a mother who has Alzheimer's, and she's dealing with caregiving issues. Another friend is writing about her struggles to get healthy through various means. Okay. So, but I like, I like that guy. Shoot, I can't remember his name. Okay, that was really helpful.
We'll put that in later. Okay. She likes that guy.
That guy.
I want to thank you, Julia Harris, from the Ohio State University's On Campus, which is also available online. So you don't have to work at OSU to get it now. You can go online to get it. And we'll put that up. So thank you.
Thank you.
From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at the Ohio State University, this is Doug Dangler saying, keep writing.